Thank you so much for having me back. Thank you for your warm welcome to Kirkliston. Thank you to Colin and Melissa for leading the service. Thanks to Andy for leading us in the singing of God's praises, and for Gavin as he's prayed. I think it's all come together really, really nicely to serve the teaching of the word this morning. I join you, as a church family, are looking at Matthew's gospel. Each Sunday, you've been looking at the theme of identity. And through the pages of his word, God has been teaching you about the identity of his kingdom, what his kingdom looks like, what it stands for. And then last week, you'll have looked at the identity of his disciples. What does it look like to be a citizen of that kingdom? What does it look like to be a follower of Jesus? And you'll have heard words of encouragement and words of warning from Jesus in Matthew chapter 10. So Jesus speaks very honestly about the life of a disciple. He is very clear that a disciple suffers, but also that a disciple endures as he or she is cared for by the Father. And you'll have heard Jesus' stark words in chapter 10, verses 32 and 33, where Jesus says, "Whoever acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge him before my Father in heaven. But whoever disowns me before men, I will disown him before my Father in heaven." Jesus is very transparent about the consequences of following him and the consequences of rejecting him. And as we move into Matthew chapter 11, we focus in on the identity of God's Messiah. That's what we're looking at this morning, the identity of God's Messiah. And actually, Jesus' identity is one of the themes that Matthew develops right from the word go in his gospel. Matthew is aiming to teach us about Jesus. He wants to teach us about Jesus' significance in human history, who Jesus was, why Jesus came. And the start of Matthew's gospel reminds us of the story so far, the story up until Jesus' arrival. In chapter 1, we see that Jesus' identity is heavenly royalty. He is born into the line of the great Old Testament King David. He is the rightful king of God's people, the authoritative son of David. And then the end of Matthew points to the story still to come, the story after Jesus' resurrection and ascension. In chapter 28, Jesus commissions his apostles to go and make disciples of all nations. He says to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. I am with you to the very end of the age." So Matthew in his gospel is explaining Jesus' victory over sin, Satan, and death, and how his followers are to respond to that victory. And as we zoom back into this section of Matthew's gospel, chapters 10 through 12, the one reality that you cannot miss is that the message of the Messiah, his identity, his mission, his kingdom, carries inevitable confrontation with the world around about him. So I remember once being asked when I was at university, "Well, if the gospel that you believe as a Christian is so good, if Jesus is so worth following, why don't more people do it? Why don't more people follow him?" Good question. The truth is that Jesus' words, Jesus' kingdom, are divisive, and they cause a whole manner of reactions in the hearts of the listeners. And you'll see that even more plainly when you get to chapter 13. Not everyone is going to like him. Not everyone is going to like the gospel. It leads to confrontation. It's the consequence of God's kingdom colliding with the kingdom of this world. And I don't think any of that will come as a surprise to any of us. He is authoritative, but his authority does not go unchallenged. Kingdom living means worldly confrontation. And actually, it's the religious leaders in Matthew and the crowds in Matthew that are supposed to be waiting for a Messiah. They're supposed to be the ones that will recognize him. But they turn their back on him. And as all of this is happening around about, we have in chapter 11, in the first 19 verses, what initially I think seems like a strange interaction between John and John's disciples and Jesus. I wonder how you felt and how you reacted as Colin read it out for us just there. So the question that John's disciples ask on John's behalf in verse 3 seems like an odd question for John the Baptist to ask. And then Jesus' response in verses 4 to 6 seems somewhat enigmatic. And then his words in verse 7 onwards seem even more enigmatic as he turns to the crowd. So how are we to make head or tail of the situation? How do these words shape our understanding of the identity of the Messiah? Well, let's look at our passage this morning under two headings. Both of them will appear on the screen behind me. The first is in the first 15 verses, where we see John's doubting response to the Messiah. And then the second is just in the last four verses, verses 16 to 19, the crowd's dangerous response to the Messiah. So firstly, John's doubting response to the Messiah, the confrontation that comes as the reality of Jesus' kingdom had landed John, verse 2, in prison. And imagine what's going through John's head as he sits in a Roman jail. It's an unforgiving ordeal. John would be unsure of his own safety, unsure of the immediate future, only catching glimpses of what's happening in the outside world, hearing snippets of information here and there. See, John would be wondering exactly the same thing that we would be wondering were we to be in his situation. If Jesus really is the Messiah, if he really is the rescuer, why does John look and feel distinctly unrescued? If Jesus is the one who will redeem God's people, why is John languishing in a Roman jail? Where is the justice that Jesus had promised? John had gone to jail for what he believed. But has John backed the wrong man? Has he wasted everything? See, all of these questions are contained within the question John asks through his disciples in verse 3. Are you the one who was to come? Or should we expect someone else? Familiar questions, aren't they? If Jesus really is the Messiah, the one to end all of the suffering and evil that we see around about us, then why do we feel the pain of that every single day? If Jesus really is the rescuer, then why is our church so unrescued? Why is it being persecuted across the whole world? Why are so many of our brothers and sisters that we were praying for earlier languishing in jails in other countries? Where is the justice from our just God that he promised? And if you've been a Christian here this morning for any length of time, you will feel like you've invested a lot. You've staked a lot on the premise that Christianity is true and that Jesus' identity really is the Messiah. And yet in the face of the persecution that we've seen in these chapters of Matthew and felt in our own lives, it can easily feel like we've backed the wrong man and we've backed the losing team. Ever thought that? Ever felt that way? John's question in verse 3 is our question today. Jesus, are you really the Messiah? But the Bible doesn't shy away from questions like that. The Bible speaks realistically about the doubts that genuine believers face from time to time. And I think that's an important lesson to learn for God's people from Matthew 11. John's doubting response to the Messiah means that genuine believers genuinely doubt from time to time. And we mustn't feel guilty about the doubts that you or I experience on a day-to-day basis. See, Jesus is big enough and strong enough to handle any uncertainty on our part. it doesn't mean that our salvation has hit the rocks. The truth of who he was, the truth of why he came, never ever depended on how clearly I understood him and understood it and understood the gospel. Jesus' identity as Messiah doesn't become less true if I experience doubts along the way. But what's significant here in the case with John and John's disciples is that John takes his doubts and questions to the Lord Jesus rather than sitting on them, letting them fester, or allowing those doubts and questions to drive him away from the Lord. He asks Jesus directly. Isn't that a good pattern for any believer to follow? John takes his doubts straight to his Messiah and listen to Jesus' response in verses 4-6. Go back and report to John what you see and hear. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the good news is proclaimed to the poor. See, John is stuck in prison. He hasn't seen the full and final fulfillment of Jesus' work on earth. He won't see the cross with his own eyes. He won't see the empty tomb with his own eyes. But Jesus' point here is that John the Baptist, well, John has seen enough. He has seen the Messiah. He has, verse 2, heard about the deeds of the Messiah. He's heard about what Christ has been doing. And as far as Jesus is concerned, that is enough for John. See, the works of Jesus, the words of Jesus, are all that the believer needs to hear to believe that Jesus really was who he said he was. The works of Jesus, the words of Jesus, are all the believer needs to hear to believe that Jesus really was the Messiah. See, Jesus' words and works teach and reteach every time we read them that he really is the authoritative, victorious Messiah King. It's often the case in the Bible, and you notice this when you read through the Psalms and lots of the Old Testament. It's often the case that whenever the believer expresses doubt or uncertainty, and you can think of the Psalms and King David and lots of questions about why these things are happening, God's response is often, remember who I am. Remember what you have seen. Remember what I have done for my people. Remember what I have promised you. There isn't always a nice, neatly packaged answer to the specific suffering that you and I face on a day-to-day basis. But the response that the Lord gives is to say, remember who I am and remember what you have seen. Jesus has not completely put an end to all the evil that we see around about us, but his works and his words are all that we need this morning to believe that Jesus really was the Messiah. And they're enough for us to believe that he will return. So Jesus' call on John and on the life of the believer in response to this, verse 6, is to stand firm. Blessed is the man who does not fall away on account of me. Stand strong, John, because there is ample evidence of Jesus' power and authority to dispel your doubts. And if John had enough of a reason to believe, then we certainly do too. We have even more reason to believe. We have the empty cross and the empty grave to remind us, to reteach us time and time again that we really are fully forgiven of our sin. Death is not the end for us. There is always enough evidence for Jesus, our Messiah, and his kingdom. We just need to be told it every single day. And the other important thing for us to notice is that Jesus' response to John's line of questioning is to reaffirm John's place in Jesus' kingdom. See the question that Jesus turns and asks the crowd in verse 7? What did you go out into the desert to see? A reed swayed by the wind? A man dressed in fine clothes? That doesn't sound like John the Baptist. He had a calling and a conviction, and he stuck to it, even though it landed him in jail, potentially costing him both his freedom and his life. A reed swaying as the wind presses on it? Nah, that's not our John. He wasn't one to bend to the will of the world around about him. He stayed firm on his convictions. A man dressed in fine clothes? Nah, that's not our John. There isn't that much that is physically impressive about him. A prophet? Yes. And I tell you, more than a prophet, says Jesus in verse 9. And they'll go on and say in verse 11, among those born of women, there has not risen anyone greater than John the Baptist. Isn't that an astonishing thing to say about the man who has just had to ask Jesus if he really was the Messiah? Even John the Baptist, the man that Jesus would say there has not arisen anyone greater, still occasionally had his doubts whether Jesus really was who he said he was. But Jesus' response is not to kick him out of the gang. His response is kind and gentle, as Jesus publicly reinforces not only his identity as Messiah, but John's role in his service. So what does that mean for us? Well, one of the privileges I've had as I grew up at my church in Glasgow is a shameless loyalty towards any hymn written in the 1800s. And there are some wonderfully rich words written by wise Christian men and women, full of nourishing gospel content for us to sing as his people. But there are some words, I think well-meaning words, that we might want to stop singing, or at least carefully explain. Let's go with that. At least carefully explain before we sing them together. And I'm really sorry if you love these hymns. I do too. But I wonder if they might occasionally be unhelpful. For example, not a shadow can rise, not a cloud in the skies, but his smile quickly drives it away. Okay, I'm with you so far. Not a doubt or a fear, not a sigh or a tear can abide while we trust and obey. Not a doubt can abide while we trust in Jesus. Is that what we see in Matthew chapter 11? Again, listen to these words from another hymn. To doubt would be disloyalty. To falter would be sin. To doubt would be disloyalty towards our Jesus. I think the problem with the above sentiments is that in our moments of doubt and uncertainty, we feel guilty and we hide. We kind of shy away from the Lord and hope that he hasn't noticed. But truth be told, listening to the interaction between Jesus and John in Matthew chapter 11, the reality is that Jesus invites us to take our doubts to him and find the answers to our doubts in him and in his identity as the Messiah. Our salvation is not in jeopardy when we doubt. Not if we stand firm on our convictions and take our doubts to the Lord. So Kirkliston, turn to Christ. Turn in your uncertainty and see that 2,000 years ago, as Jesus walks the earth, the blind receive sight. The lame walk. Those who have skin diseases are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead are raised. The good news is proclaimed to the poor. Death is dead. Love has won. Christ has risen. That is enough for any believer. That is the Christ-given antidote to the doubts that you and I feel on a day-to-day basis. Let him, let his words, let his deeds remind you this morning and remind you in the days to come that he really is the Messiah. Even when we're sitting in whatever prison we find ourselves, surrounded by whatever doubts are racing through our hearts and through our minds. Are you the one who was to come, or should we expect someone else? Yes, John, he is. John's doubting response to the Messiah, and with our remaining time this morning, the crowd's dangerous response to the Messiah in the last four verses. The crowd's dangerous response to the Messiah. Jesus' tone towards the doubts of a genuine believer like John, Jesus' tone is kind and warm. The contrast here in these final four verses is stark. So verse 16, Jesus says, "To what can I compare this generation? They are like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling out to others, 'We played the pipe for you and you didn't dance. We sang a dirge and you didn't mourn.'" There's a video of me aged six, and the video is of me on an Easter Sunday a long, long time ago now. And the Hamilton family have an annual, had, tragically it's no longer in existence, we had an annual Easter Sunday tradition as a family of boiling eggs and rolling them down a hill. I believe to symbolize the stone being rolled away. Why we used eggs and not just a stone, I'm not sure. Eggs it was. Maybe because we could paint them and make them look nice. But there's a video of me aged six or seven rolling an egg down a hill. And because I have zero hand-eye coordination, it didn't go well. And I can't really recall what happened, but I kicked off in a big way. I cried, I moaned, I didn't want another egg, and I would not calm down. I was petulant because I wasn't getting my own way, and I grumbled. And that is the reaction of the crowd listening to Jesus. He says that they are like children sitting in a marketplace, and amidst all of the noise and bustle that is happening around about them, they're annoyed that nobody is dancing to their tune. "We played the pipe for you and you didn't dance. We sang a dirge and you didn't mourn." This generation, the crowd listening to Jesus, have received the two greatest messengers from God that had ever been seen, John the Baptist, Jesus the Messiah. And yet this generation, this crowd, rejects them both. This generation has been a petulant generation. They are not getting God's kingdom the way that they want. They're not getting God's Messiah King the way that they want. And so they grumble. Impossible to please. John, what's the response to John? Well, verse 18, "He came neither eating nor drinking," and they said, "Oh, he has a demon." Jesus, what's the response to Jesus? Well, verse 19, "The Son of Man came eating and drinking," in contrast to John, and they say, "Oh, here's a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners." See, the crowd will stubbornly find a reason to dislike the message. They'll find a reason to dislike the messenger, and they'll find a reason to dismiss all of the above. This generation repeatedly finds reasons to reject the message of John and reject the message of Jesus. And it's the same story 2,000 years later. Nothing has changed. I can think of a conversation I had, again, as a student with a chap that I didn't really know very well. I met him at a CU event in Glasgow, and he asked me a fairly aggressive question about church politics and the abuse of power in churches throughout the generations. And as I began to kind of discuss the answer with him, I could see it almost kind of visibly on his face that he was beginning already to formulate the next aggressive question that he was going to ask without even listening to the response. He was already determined in his rejection of the gospel. He was already determined in his rejection of Jesus. Or maybe in our own evangelism, as we've tried to talk to friends, family about Jesus, we think, you know, if only they saw Jesus with their own eyes, if only Jesus walked around us still today, people would see him and see what he was doing and place their faith and trust in him. But I think Matthew chapter 11 shows us that the natural inclination of the human heart 2,000 years ago or today is to dislike something about the gospel, dislike something about Jesus, dislike someone in the church, and then to use that to write off the good news of Christianity completely. It's sad, but it's realistic. It's a warning from Jesus that the men and women around him are in a very, very dangerous place when they do so. To reject Jesus is to reject salvation. You see that in the verses that follow, perhaps next week if you're covering them. This passage teaches us that Jesus will tolerate and reassure us in our doubts, but he will not tolerate or reassure a petulant, grumbling rejection of his identity and his kingdom. The crowds cannot presume on the grace and mercy of God forever. There is an eternal price to be paid for opposition to Jesus and his kingdom. See, what I needed aged 6 or 7, standing outside my grandparents' house, egg everywhere, was the firm rebuke of an authoritative figure. I think it was my mum in the end who had a few words to say. Well, Jesus' words here are a firm rebuke to the crowds from an authoritative figure. And that note of warning is where we leave our passage this morning. But let's be aware that our tendency to grumble at the gospel, to reject the rescuer, still lingers in our hearts, doesn't it? But he doesn't leave us in our sinfulness. His call is to turn to him, whether it's in doubt, like John, or whether it's in sinful rejection, like the crowds, and trust in his salvation as our Messiah. His words, our Messiah's words, and his works are an invitation to the doubter to place his or her doubts on Jesus, to look at what he has done, to listen to what he has said, and to see that he is a good, kind king who can handle our doubts. Jesus' words are Messiah's words, and his works are a rebuke to any stubborn, sinful rejection of his kingdom, whether in our hearts or in the hearts of those around about us. He is exactly the Messiah that we need. So let's be a people that regularly turn to his words, turn to his works, so that he can correct us, so that he can make us every single day more and more like him. Let me pray for us. Let me ask that God will do that in our hearts by his Spirit.